May 9th, 2007. And we're actually going to start with our informational meeting session on the Mid-Columbia Steelhead Recovery Plan, since we made ODFW sit through 2 hours of hearings before and is generous enough to come back and share with us and provide an update on what's been happening with that very important Steelhead Recovery Plan. So I am going to open up an informational meeting on the Mid-Columbia Steelhead Recovery Plan and ask Ed Bowles and Bruce McIntosh from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to come up and share with us what is the latest on that. Thank you, gentlemen. I apologize. I think you were up on the agenda about a month or so ago and got preempted by some very important legislation. So,
Chair Dingfelder, you're right. It was on very important obsolete computer hardware. So I learned a lot that session.
I'm sure Steelhead used computers on occasion, right?
Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee, I'm Ed Bowles, the Fish Division Administrator. I wanted to bring up Bruce McIntosh with me, who just to introduce you to him. He heads up our recovery planning section that's dealing with all of the federal recovery plans that we're doing. And so he's here just to get some exposure, and if you got any tough questions, I'll defer them to him. So what I wanted to do was just walk through. I know there's an interest in the focus on the Mid-Columbia Steelhead, so we'll use that as our platform. If you'd like to talk about any of the other recovery planning efforts we're embarking on, we're certainly available to chat about those as well. We've got within Oregon right now 12 what we call DPSs or ESUs. These are the groupings of populations that are federally listed under evolutionary significant units or distinct population segments. And those 12 represent those areas where Oregon is taking a lead role or a secondary role in developing recovery plans for. So I wanted to bring to your attention, many of these are interjurisdictional, so we're not the only sheriff in town, so to speak. We've got very cooperative planning efforts going on with other states. The most important ones for that are the Snake River grouping of populations, and there are four distinct groups within that. The Steelhead, and those are summer steelhead. We've got fall Chinook, and then the spring summer Chinook and the sockeye. Those span Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. We've got Mid-Columbia River Steelhead that we're going to talk to you about today, which is Washington and Oregon. In the lower river, Washington, Oregon have the four species within the lower river that we're working on, and then the upper Willamette, two species as well. On this map, you'll see Oregon Coast Coho identified. They are currently not listed through an assessment by the NOAA Fisheries. That is still under consideration in the courts right now, but as of now, this time they're not listed. The one that's missing on the bottom here, which is not in the northwest region of NOAA Fisheries, is the Southern Oregon, Northern California Coho, which includes the Klamath area, and that is another one that we're currently working on. So that's the context of recovery plans that we're doing right now. Now, within the Mid-Columbia River Steelhead ESU, there's a number of different populations within that, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on here, just to show you that there are different groupings, and the Oregon subunit has a number of different populations. We'll get into that, but there's also groupings within Washington, three different groupings there, and we have to ensure for federal delisting that all of these are performing well, not just the Oregon component. Kind of the organization of this, and as you're well aware, Oregon has a long process of ensuring public collaboration in these sort of efforts. And we've got joint federal, state, and tribal effort to go with that sounding board, which is our kind of public group that includes also quasi-agency sorts and all of the internal agencies within Oregon. So we've got the local communities and their leaders, ag and timber, land managers, the different governing bodies, tribal industry, and environmental leaders. They're providing input to the plan. They're not a decision-making body, but they're advisory. And we really want as much ownership as possible in these plans. What are the components of recovery plans? This is all very logic-driven. We need to know where are we now relative to the fish. We need to know where we want to be relative to, in this case, delisting criteria for Federal Endangered Species Act. And we look at that from the standpoint of the biological status of the fish and the threats to those fish. And then there's another bar, if you will, that goes beyond that, which is really the Oregon plan perspective on this, which is not just delisting so that they're viable, but that they're also providing cultural and economic benefits to the state of Oregon. Now, once you figure out whether there's a gap between where we are and where we want to be, the next important issue is how do we get there to close that gap? We look at what is causing the gap, the limiting factors and the threats. What are the management actions we can take and look at the costs of those physically and socially. A very important piece of this is all of this is going to take place in the face of pretty dramatic uncertainty, and so it's very important that we have good monitoring program in place to learn as we go so that we can adjust the course. We need to know actually when we get there, and if our assumptions were wrong moving forward, we need to be able to adjust course and adapt accordingly. So given that as the backdrop, we're going to just walk briefly through those elements, the first being where are we now, and this is just a kind of simplistic version of the steelhead within Oregon. These are the populations. I'd like to point the majority of them are in this qualitative medium range of performance, their status. I want to mention that of the listed species that we have throughout the region, our steelhead are not at all on the bottom of the list regarding performance. Recovery and delisting is achievable. This isn't way out there like we have for some of our, it's going to be much more difficult for some of the Snake River populations and for Washington, the Upper Columbia. But for Mid-Columbia steelhead, it is realistic. It's reasonable. In order to get there, we've got a couple populations already performing adequately for getting close to delisting. We've got other ones that have tremendous work ahead, but it's doable.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question? On that last slide, I guess, could you talk a little more about what medium population status means or high and where the delisting level is on that chart and how this compares to historical populations? I guess I'm struggling to understand what those, you said they were qualitative, but what they really mean.
Chair Dingfelder and Representative Cannon, this represents, as I said, a qualitative assessment just to give you some perspective of what we're looking at. I would not equate this as relative to their historical performance. This is not close to their historical performance. This represents their performance compared to viability assessed by technical teams, scientists, that look at what does it take for these fish to be performing at a level that actually allows them to persist into the future, and so sustainable into the future. And in many cases, this may represent a delisting scenario, which I'm going to show you in a minute here, may represent only perhaps 20% of historic potential. But it still is viable in the future under the definitions of the Endangered Species Act. These don't even represent just numbers of fish. There are several aspects of the fish that we look at. We look at their abundance, their survivability, or what we call productivity. We look at their distribution throughout the range. You don't want all your eggs in one basket, one tributary of the watersheds. And so we've got the diversity of those characteristics of the fish that we all consider. this is wrapped up to kind of give you an estimate of kind of, you know, where we're at now relative to that. And medium says that we're not there, but we're not way down either, Representative Cannon, on this. We're trying to get, I'm going to show you next one if I could. This shows a potential recovery scenario where you're making choices of which ones would have to move up so that you actually get to this delisting sort of characterization. In this case, all but two have to move, and some have to move up dramatically or further all the way to the very high performance, others just to the high. And the reason that you have that distinction is, for example, those that are very unique, that have no real replacements to them, such as 15 Mile Creek, there's nothing else like that. So you want to make sure that that's firing on all cylinders since you have nothing to replace it with. Other ones, you may have them as what we call metapopulations. They're very important because they are the driver for other populations. So that's what we call a recovery scenario. Now,
Hold on, Representative Burley has a question.
Thank you. Add back a couple of slides. You know, where are we now? Where do we want to be? How do we get there? How do we know we're there? Under that second bullet, where do we want to be? It talks about recovery delisting criteria, biological and threats. And in your example delisting scenario, as you pointed out, you know, this medium, high, very high is all very subjective, qualitative, if you will. And one of the issues with the Endangered Species Act all along has been, how do we define the recovery criteria? How do we know when we've gotten there? What's measurable? What are we, you know, is it habitat? Is it number of species in the distinct population segment? Or what is it? Have we, in this case with the steelhead, have we actually quantified any of those variables? Established those quantifiable targets?
Chair Dinkfelder and Representative Burley, yes, as I mentioned to Representative Cannon, this depicts kind of a qualitative look at this. The actual standards that we have for recovery are very, quantitative. They have to do with numbers of fish. They have to do with what we call the adult fish that come back from the parents that produce them, and we call it recruits per spawner. That's the productivity measurement. And you have those across a range of abundances of fish coming in. You have specific criteria for distribution, how many of the historical watersheds actually have fish in them now, the diversity characteristics of fish, run timing, things like that. So it's a very quantified component. Where there's discretion is in the understanding that not every population has to be as strong as every other population in order to be viable long term. And that's where some discretion comes in as to, from a policy standpoint, of which populations are we going to focus habitat measures on, or things like that, based on cost and benefits. But the scientific analysis of what they need to persist into the future is fairly refined and fairly quantified. This does not do it justice. We put it in this form simply to try to cut to a generic chase. And these curves, these productivity curves that we have, other things, we're happy to share with you. It's in the recovery plans, the draft that's out right now.
Okay. Thank you.
Looking at what constrains the viability of these in order to get them to move up to where those arrows are going, we mainly look at the factors that are limiting the fish right now, and then the threats that could hurt them in the future. I'm going to talk just general conclusions here, and if you'd like to go into details, Bruce and I can cover that for you. But in general, we call it the kind of four H's: hydro, hatcheries, habitat, and harvest. We've got moderate hydropower impacts, not as much obviously as the interior populations, but the Columbia and Deschutes River both, as you're aware, we have through FERC relicensing an agreement moving forward on the Pelton Round Butte in the Deschutes, and a management plan adopted by our Fish and Wildlife Commission to actually open up those areas above that for reestablishment of an Agemas salmon and steelhead. And so that's a very important step that we're taking. The issue with hatcheries is one of strays. This has been around for a while and in the news, but the Deschutes has fairly good water quality with cool water temperatures, and in the summertime it's very attractive to fish moving up the Columbia that are in temperatures, water temperatures that they don't like. They suddenly feel those cool water temperatures and they pop in, steelhead particularly, to the Deschutes, and some of them stay and actually spawn there. And that's a concern of ours because those are fish that aren't endemic to that drainage. And many of them are destined for Idaho, and they end up in there. Some other ones are some hatchery fish from our Wallawa hatchery. So we're taking actions to try to minimize that, both with our hatcheries and with operations, to try to ensure that there's not that sort of attractant, if you will, that forces these outside hatchery fish to stray into the Deschutes.
When you finish the slide, and then we'll
and
take
then on habitat, we're looking at just the general things that you're all aware of, degraded habitat throughout the mid-Columbia steelhead range of landscapes. Looking at those, we'll talk a little bit about how we're going about doing that in the future. Harvest is not a significant issue from our perspective on this. We have marked selective fisheries on this. Keep going.
Representative Burley had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple things. One, I just want to let you know I do my best to try and help deal with the strays that are in lower shoots.
I had a feeling that was coming up.
But seriously, the reintroduction of the steelhead above the Pelton Roundview complex, which I think is an absolutely phenomenal effort and something I think is going to be wonderful. But the question I've always had, and I've really not gotten a good answer to it yet, is the fish, when reintroduced, what status will they have under the Endangered Species Act above Pelton Round Butte?
Shadine Felder, Representative Burley. This is all part of their historical range, and so those fish will become part of the listed unit. We just had, and I don't know if anybody was able to participate in it, but we're just in the process of doing the first experimental releases of fish in order to see how they do and to test how well they move through the reservoir system. And as I understand it, and I may have to check back on that, but I think we've got an experimental status for those at this time so that those are not classified as listed fish to start with. But eventually you will get to a point once the program goes from testing where these are actually contributing. And this is hopefully going to be a good thing, because as this habitat is opened up, it will hopefully allow greater abundance of steelhead to come back to the Deschutes, which is one of the current limits to the Deschutes, and could lead towards delisting by opening up that habitat. So we're hopeful of that. I'm not certain, and maybe Bruce knows, but I think the releases that we're just in the process of doing, late April and May, the early ones are not are in experimental status because of concerns with landowners.
Follow up.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask that you get back to me with a definitive answer to that. This has been of some concern to folks in Central Oregon, particularly in the ag sector and the forestry sector. I think it's safe to say that people recognize the value in reintroducing them, but they don't necessarily want the baggage that comes with it, if I may be so blunt, with the Endangered Species Act. We have discussed with NOAA Fisheries about the possibility of, I think it's Section 10J under ESA, to get that experimental designation. And last understanding I had was the answer was no. So I'd like to get that clarified, if I may, please.
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Burley, I will do that for you. Would you like me to report to you directly on that?
And with a memo would be fine.
Yeah. Thank you. Didn't share with the committee.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
I'd like to also point out that there are currently listed species in the watersheds, bull trout. Mm-hmm. And so the habitat issues kind of cross species lines, and so we don't anticipate either way that this will be sort of regulatory burden on other landowners. One other aspect that we're finding right now in arguing for habitat actions, and this is taking place for what's called off-site mitigation habitat actions through Bonneville, Power, and others, is there's some good projects up in the Bend area, Representative Burley, you know, in your backyard, that we would really like to get funded, and currently we're having a tough time justifying it because of that. And this would open up the opportunity for some additional resources to work on habitat as well. So hopefully we can do it in a way that is, and we're going to talk about that in a couple slides, very non-regulatory, voluntary cooperative conservation.
Quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
And thank you for that. And I don't want to sound in any way whatsoever opposed to this. I mean, I recently got appointed to the board for the Upper Deschutes Watershed Council. I believe very firmly in good habitat restoration efforts, and I support that kind of stuff. And I think the incentive and voluntary program, as is typified in the Oregon Salmon Recovery Plan, are the types of measures we'd like to do. My concern is that with ESA status, we start seeing, you know, a proliferation of lawsuits against ranchers and whatnot. Yeah, we're already dealing with a bull trout up on the forest lands, but it's that intermediate habitat that's of some concern. So that's my
thank
hence
you.
The question. Thank you.
Going to just get into some of the few more details here. Hydropower piece of this, as far as actions, we're really not doing anything separate from what's going on in the remand of the biological opinion for the operation of the Federal Columbia River Power System. And so that's where the Columbia River stuff will be taken care of. There's nothing new in this plan that would be different from that. The Deschutes, we've already talked about, the Pelton Round Butte, as far as passage and reintroductions. And I'd like to say that that's not an easy or sure thing. We've got huge technical hurdles ahead of us. No dams are coming out in the Deschutes, and so this is a passage issue that is technologically challenging. And then the reintroductions have issues associated with them as well. We do not want pathogens moved up into those blue ribbon trout fishing areas, and so we're being very careful with how we move about this. Harvest, no new actions proposed. We'll continue the conservation management that supports the rebuilding and the access to the selective fisheries. Hatcheries, getting a better handle on the strays. I'd like to mention that because we're bringing these forward to you out of the draft recovery plan, and so I've got tags on here that indicate the sounding board. Some of these were consensus sort of things, some were non-consensus. This represents a non-consensus bullet, if you will. Some of our management partners, tribes in particular, are not always supportive of the tagging and marking programs. Mass marking to improve the removal programs, evaluating the brood stocks. This is the Grand Ron hatchery issues I talked about, and then the strain. We've been alluding to the habitat strategy, and this is consistent, as Representative Burley said, with the Oregon Plan approach. It's the approach that we also took in developing the recovery plan for coastal coho. There's a current, we want to maintain the current regulatory backdrop associated with those programs, the forest practices, Senate Bill 1010, harvest management, and then the movement forward through the habitat restoration would take place under cooperative conservation, and these are voluntary incentive-based efforts that we've got a good long-running model supporting this. We've got good relationships with many of the land-based interest in trying to move this forward in a way that allows them to be full owners and participants in this, primarily focusing on giving them the technical resources and the financial resources to do things on to help the fish, which we're finding most of them do want to do. Getting at how do we know we're there? This research monitoring and evaluation component is very critical in my mind because it allows us to make decisions and actually implement. And I've been very frustrated in the past that it seems so difficult to get beyond recovery planning to recovery implementation. And because everybody wants everything final and every I dotted, T crossed before we ever get a plan done, there's going to be uncertainty. The key is to have the monitoring in place and the governance structure in place that allows us to adapt as we go. And that keeps us from getting high-centered on the planning side of this. And this is a point that we're working through the resources to do this now. Timelines, and if we have time, I'll have Bruce chat a little bit about some of the other recovery plans at your discretion, Jardine Felder. But we've got, for the Mid-Columbia, I've got a draft out right now to the sounding board members and the agencies. We plan to hopefully have a draft out, hopefully that's still the timeline, July of 07, that's the summer, for public consumption. The snake will be fall of 07, Lower Columbia. And these have lots of different species in them. These are just the domains, they're called. January of 08, and then April of 08 for the Upper Willamette, and then that Southern Oregon, Northern California, which includes Klamath, those would be summer of 08 as well. So very ambitious schedule. Got a lot of effort put forward on this, both us and OWEB dedicating significant resources that I'll be chatting with you about in Ways and Means, perhaps tomorrow on that as well, of the resources we're putting towards this. Any questions at this point? And would you like to, Chair Dingfelder, hear a little bit about the other recovery plans in a very cursory fashion? Or
yeah, I think if you can, maybe in 5 minutes or so, if you can just walk through very quickly. The other question I have, though, is you mentioned the Oregon plan for salmon and watersheds. Can you talk a little bit about the role that ODF&W plays in the Oregon plan and working with watershed councils? Because I think it's important for committee members who haven't directly, there's some of us who have served or worked with watershed councils, but about your role and the role that watershed councils play in the recovery planning process.
Sure. Chair Dingfelder, and much of what I've been presenting here today, I am not presenting, you know, parochially as ODFW. These recovery planning efforts are of high priority for the state of Oregon via the governor's office, and these teams that we have in place that are pursuing getting these done are really organized through the core team of the Oregon plan. And so this is a high priority of the Oregon plan right now, is to assist the federal government in getting past the recovery phase into implementation, and let's get some things going. And so ODFW is a role player within these recovery planning efforts, albeit a key role in working with the other natural resource agencies within state government in order to implement these. We work very closely in developing these recovery plans to ensure our information is consistent with our statutory authorities. And so we are simply advisory in providing technical information relative to actions that would take place for habitat and other things, providing those technical assistance and the incentives. But we do not have any regulatory authority within that arena. We work, and this is the beauty of the Oregon plan, is that we can provide the technical information on what the fish need, and quite frankly, the watershed councils and their efforts, they've become quite sophisticated and are very, they actually inform us on a lot of the eyes and ears on the fish at these local levels, and they're letting us know what are the fish doing and what are the limiting factors. So it's very iterative, Chair Dingfelder, on that front. But we basically are help provide to the Oregon plan what the fish need, how they're doing. And then the Oregon plan provides a wonderful infrastructure to actually get stuff done on the ground through OWEB and the funding structure, the Measure 66 or Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Fund. But that infrastructure on the ground to actually get things done is through that watershed council, through particularly on the west side, of implementing those programs. It provides the essential link to the landowners along with our district biologists, and we have now committed through the habitat strategy that started with the COHO plan to actually re-engage much more aggressively on ways to help landowners have the technical information, the opportunities, and the resources to help be full partners in improving habitat and moving these fish forward. But that's all via the Oregon plan. That's not Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. That's a role player in that. Is that close to what you asked?
Sure. And I want to see if there's any questions before I have you walk quickly through that, and then we'll wrap up. Any questions for the department?
Yeah. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Bruce McIntosh, and I'm with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. As Ed said, I'm heading up the efforts across the state on these recovery plans, and I want to make sure Rich Carmichael gets credit for all the great work he's doing on the Mid-Sea, because he's been leading that effort for us. As Ed said, we're working across a variety of fronts, and what is key in that is that stakeholder process, that sounding board. We kind of get different names from different places. There are Watershed Council and SWCD members on all of those, so the along with Representative Burley's on there with the forestry. There are the range of interests in there. Virtually all the domains we're working across, you know, significant co-management issues, not only within the state, but oftentimes working across two or three states at a time. A lot of coordination going on in that effort. The Lower Columbia, we've got four different species listed, some ranging like the chum to virtually non-existent, others doing better. It's a region where the population growth will be among the probably the highest as we go into the future. You know, real challenges in that. In the Willamette, it's one of the few domains that's within solely within Oregon. Significant challenges again to the growth on into the future. Large portions of the habitats are currently blocked by Corps of Engineer dams, so we're working actively with the Corps and BPA to facilitate passage at those areas. And then in the snake, that's an effort that NOAA is leading, but we're working in partnership with them in the states of Idaho and Washington. And that also is, you know, a lot of that is tied up in the biop remand, as I discussed. And then the sonk, we're just getting going on that, and it includes the Rogue and the Southern Oregon coast, and that is another one where we work with the state of California and another region of NOAA fisheries in an attempt to get a solid plan on the ground. So a lot of great participation by members of the public, a lot of good things happening, but a pretty daunting task.
Any questions for the department? Thank you. Appreciate you being here, and as you know, we are reviewing your budget in the Ways and Means right now, so this is helpful for those of us also on the Budget Committee. So
thank you.
Appreciate the update. With that, I will close the informational session on the Mid-Columbia Steelhead Recovery Plan, and colleagues, I am actually going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 707 because the grocers have requested discussing a proposal that they have. We have amendments that are not ready yet. They are not back from legislative council, so I will open up a work session on Senate Bill 707A, and I don't see any of the grocers here, so we will go out and see if we can get them. Okay, well, we'll see if we can find them, and if not, then we'll hold it over till Friday. Yeah. Brian, can you see if the grocers are out there? Oh, there's Joe. He just slipped in.
I was taking my purse out.
We got to watch out for you. It's like we have security, you know.
And I say that.
Yeah. And for the record, please state your name.
For the record, Madam Chair, my name is Joe Gilliam. I represent the Northwest Grocery Association.
Okay. Thanks for coming today. And you heard that we are opening the work session, so you can walk through. I think many of us have a memo that you handed out, and I don't know if you have additional handouts for the committee.
I have. No, I just have a copy of the letter that I requested to you. Does everyone have a copy of that letter? You'll have another copy at your office, I'm sure, in the inbox, buried someplace. So. Thank you, Madam Chair. early this morning, in a very early conference call, had a discussion with the grocers in Oregon, and we went through the 707A again, looking at the components of it, the way it was written, and the grocery industry came to the conclusion that, as written, 707 is just not going to work at the street level. In all sincerity, it's not a bluff. It's not a scare tactic. It's not politics. It is the fact it won't work. We had a further conversation on what would work, and after looking at the complexities of this, the gridlock that's been in the work groups, as this bill's come through the process, we made a decision that we were going to step up and break the gridlock. We are changing our position from opposing the model bill expansion to supporting it. We are offering you the components in this, and I think as you look at them, there are no tricks. There's no fine print. It truly is a system that mechanically works, and it actually makes a large leap ahead of where the original bill was going and actually takes you to an alternative source of redemption with a full funding mechanism. The system essentially works like this. We want to keep the original bottle bill intact until a system can be developed that can handle the capacity of accepting an expansion of the bottle bill. The expansion of the bottle bill would be all beverage containers at that point. We don't sort out water. We don't sort out flavored water. We don't decide if it's a tea, if it's a sports drink. We say all beverage containers. That is a huge jump. You will probably want exclusions. Liquid medicine, milk, some things like that. But you can be specific in the exclusions rather than general in the inclusions. We've got to know what's covered. Otherwise, the system does not work. In 2010 would be the date that would come online. In 2010, what we prescribe in our proposal is that there be redemption centers up and running at that point, and that the beverage containers move out of the store and into the redemption center process. So let's talk about how we get there a little bit. We would prescribe that, and starting in 2009, the grocers would begin to pay a 1.5 cent per container fee, handling fee to the state of Oregon. That means for every container they sell that's under the bill, we would pay the retailers 1.5 cents. On 2 billion containers, that's $30 million that would be there for capital investment in the redemption center system. After 2009, beginning in 2010, the retail community would pay 3 cents per container to run the operations of the redemption centers. That's $60 million a year in order to run the operations. You're probably going to need 150 to 200 redemption centers, different sizes, different shapes, in order to meet communities' needs. There may be some rural communities you'll want to at a certain level. I mean, maybe it doesn't make sense, but for the most part, you have to spread them out. In 2009, what we'd like to also in this bill is designate that the escheat or the unredeemed nickels in this new system be dedicated to Oregon Solve. Formerly known as Stop Oregon Litter and Vandalism, just known as Solve, probably one of the great trademarks of Oregon. They do more on the litter pickup and actually the litter issue. The reason we'd like to do that and provide that money to them is that redemption systems and container deposits only address about 1% of the litter stream because it only makes it valuable to pick up 1%. Solve isn't going to survive much longer on the finances that they have today. It will go away, and that's just a sad fact. But they do more to pick up 100% of the litter stream than anybody else in the state. 100,000 volunteers in 250 cities. There's no other organization like them, and they need to be funded. This bill would roughly fund them based on estimates from high of DEQ and the low of the distributors. I would say about $10 million, $7 to $10 million a year, someplace in there that would be available. At $10 million a year, that would triple the operating budget of Solve today. They would be able to triple their efforts. Yeah. I don't think they'd build any new big buildings. I think they'd actually pick up more trash. And that means the cigarette butts, the paper cups, the tires, 45,000 that they found so far in the metro area, computers, TVs that get dumped in streams, old mattresses, on and on and on, get covered. And we want to see that as part of a comprehensive bill. It has to be more holistic than just picking up containers. That sheet transfer would begin under our proposal in 2009.
In the end, after the redemption centers are set up and the retailers continue to pay the bill, that's out of the fresh food line, the distributor side of this is out of the game. They no longer have a mandate to pick up, a mandate to rent facilities, have any costs at all. So they are out of the system and no longer burdened by any of the costs of the system. And we made the shift. You have all the beverage containers, and you have a complete holistic system. And you've saved Oregon Solve. That is our proposal, Madam Chair.
Okay. I apologize that I was out of the room for a minute.
It's okay.
And I'm sure there's going to be lots of questions. I would like to say that it's refreshing to see, because I did sit in the work group on the other side where there was not an agreement from the grocers to move forward with the bottle bill, so expansion of the bottle bill. So it's refreshing to see the proposal. And I also would say it's refreshing to see that you're proposing a 3-cent fee that, if I'm reading this right, that the retailers would provide. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct. We would start with a 1.5-cent fee in 2009 before the redemption centers came online and the expansion took place to create capital investment for the redemption center, so you aren't starting from zero. There has to be money there to start a redemption center. And then after that, it would go to the 3 cents in 2010 for the operations of those redemption centers, and that's about $60 million.
And just another clarification I had, and then I'm sure there'll be lots of questions. I saw Representative Cannon already had his hand up. I don't see anything in here about proposal to expand the existing deposit. So your proposal, unless did I miss that?
Madam Chair, no. We kept the deposit at a nickel. The price pressure on particularly water really doesn't, you lose the public at a dime. And there seems to be comfort at that at a nickel. So you're adding a lot more things into the system. So the deposit line on your grocery receipt after 2010 is going to be larger because you're going to have more containers you're paying deposits on. And so we want to be price sensitive to the customer.
And then one final question is, how did you come up with, on the top of page 3, a sheet amounts of $7 million to $15 million? I mean, I know this was discussed in the work group, but I'm just curious, since we don't have any reporting requirements, and I've never seen an accounting system or any type of audit, how you came up with that number?
Madam Chair, there are probably two ranges of figures over the years in talking what this might be, and it is an estimation. There's zero, and there's $15 million, which really where the DEQ pegs it. Now you heard Kevin Deatley from Massachusetts and Northridge Environmental we brought in talk about how much fraud they suspect is in the system, and he has it down about $7 million. So it's someplace in between that 7 and 15 million is a pretty good guess. But, Madam Chair, you are exactly correct. No one knows exactly how many nickels are redeemed and how many nickels are kept in the system. This system would allow you to know that instantaneously, depending on how you set up your accounting systems. It could be done quarterly. It could be done yearly. But you would know, because the nickels will come to a central pot at the state, and they'll know how many nickels they received and how many nickels they paid out, and whatever's left over would go to Solve.
Okay, thank you. Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Gilliam, for coming forward with this proposal. I also want to express my appreciation for grocers sort of looking at this and trying to think about ways to make the bottle bill work. So I think this is a really good step. I do have a few questions. You note that the redemption centers would be set up and administered by the state of Oregon. So what agency, what are we talking about in terms of the size, number of employees, sort of state obligation under this, granted funded by grocers?
Well, we'd want to be a part of how it's developed, obviously, since we're paying the $60 million. But what we would envision is there's going to have to be some oversight on where those nickels go in and nickels go out, who's overseeing the counting of it. That could be either be DEQ or it could be the Department of Revenue, depending on how heavy the counting load is. In terms of running the redemption centers, I think it would be wise to look at, you know, how many could be run privately under contract or under a certain set of guidelines that they have to follow. One of the extra things I didn't bring up is we would like to see these redemption centers also take in some other items, such as batteries, taking the film, the plastic bags, and the dry cleaning film, and also household appliances, so that redemption center is more efficient.
that there's one trip there and you can do more than just take your beverage containers there. We think that's pretty important in terms of efficiencies, energy consumption, time consumption. So there may be some partnerships where you have folks in the battery industry, who are folks who are picking up film, folks who are interested in the plastic, the metal, the glass from containers that come together. I think what the state has to do is say, here are the guidelines, and we'll license you, and we'll get an agreement. You break the agreement, you're out of the system. But set up the guidelines and let them go. I don't think you want to create a whole new state agency with employees to try to figure out how to do redemption. I think you leave that to the recycling community, who knows how to do it.
Madam Chair, just a clarification. But we are, I want to make it clear, I think, if I understand this correctly, we are talking about ultimately $60 million per year that the state collects in nickels and then pays out perhaps for contracted services or perhaps for state-run redemption centers. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, that is correct.
And one more question, and then I actually have a bunch, but I'm happy to let others get in here.
Spread it around a little bit. Okay. We'll let Representative Smith ask a couple, and then we'll come back.
So, I think I heard you mention 150 to 200 redemption centers. How did you develop that estimate, and how does that compare with the number of places that customers, citizens of Oregon, can currently go to redeem their deposits?
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, technically you have pretty close to 2,000 redemption centers today, if you count all the mom and pops and anybody who is required to take back bottles and cans. But what we know is about 300 stores to 350 take back 90% of the redemption right now. There are some efficiencies you can get in this. There are a lot of those grocery stores in that 350 that are on the same street, on the same block, or opposing each other on an intersection. There's probably, particularly in metro areas, there's four or five, six stores that you could have one redemption center for. And so you'd save some time, money, and effort in just consolidating. So I think you could get this down to under the 300 mark, and I think you could get down to more closer to 200. We're going to have to look at, you take the city of Tillamook. They have one center for their recyclables right now. It works great for them, but they figured it out as a rural community. It's just dead center in town. You go one spot and you drop it. So for the whole community, it's one spot.
Thanks. I've got more, but...
we'll let Representative Smith ask his question, then we'll come back and see if there's other folks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I think this is a very special day in Oregon's history. I think today's actually a groundbreaking day in Oregon's history where business and the environment are coming together with a solution that creates a win-win. Rather than gridlock... you brought us a real solution, a solution that's good for the environment, it's good for the consumer, and it's good for business. I just want to make sure of something. I live in small little rural Oregon, community of Heppner, and as I look at your overview, in my small little community of Heppner, we're going to have an opportunity to recycle all beverage containers, not just beer and soda and potentially water, but all. Is that's accurate?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, yes, that'd be accurate. Less any exclusions as a policy, but the medicine and the milk and that type of thing. When I say exclusions, I'm not talking about excluding a brand or a broad category. I think there's enough language out there in some of the other bills mm-hmm. that were the four or five that presented that I think the language is done. It's just you got to kind of pick one.
One last question, Madam Chair. And again, living in rural Eastern Oregon, one of the issues we faced is a lot of our small grocers, they close shop at 6, 7 o'clock at night. Do you envision these recycling centers, especially in rural Oregon, being available to accommodate folks who perhaps want to go recycle at 6 a.m. in the morning or want to be able to take their recycled material at 7, 8 p.m. at night?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, we do envision that. I don't want to get too prescriptive in the bill saying, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., but sure. I think they you got to work out in the contracts with folks what the convenient hours are. And they could be open, after 5, after 6, maybe they're open till 8 o'clock. And each, within a set of guidelines, each city maybe wanted to make it different for their town.
Just to follow up, would it be okay for me to envision, rather than a sophisticated recycling center, maybe we just have compartmentalized dumpsters, if you will, to where we could come and put in our plastics and our glass and separate it all out. And if we wanted to do it at 1 in the morning, we would have a location in South Morrow County where it's open to the public to just come put it into the dumpsters.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, you could do that, but you're probably going to want some kind of manned unit because you're going to have deposits involved. And so that doesn't mean you couldn't have, in some areas, just you know, unmanned reverse vending machines.
Got it.
But you're, you know, you've got to have some service. I mean, one of the great fallacies is when you put the can in that hole, it doesn't disappear. There's actually a guy that goes in behind there and pulls the cart out and empties it about every 2 hours. The stuff goes someplace. So you have to have that kind of service in it. So you're going to see some labor involved.
So there still is the redemption portion of the spill?
Yes.
Of the law?
Yes, yeah. You can still have that deposit on all those containers.
Great job. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay. Did anybody else, Representative McPherson, I know Representative Berger, who was able to join us, and then we'll go back to Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gillian, I'm just trying to understand the mechanics of this. Let's look at after January 1, 2010, after this, the new system is fully operational. Under the current system, we have consortiums of distributors who are actually handling the recycling of the material, as we're moving it into the recycling stream. And it looks to me like this would eliminate that level entirely. So that in what the work that's being done now at the distributor level would be done at the basically at the redemption center level run by the state with funded with the dollars that are coming from the retailers. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative McPherson, that is correct. There would be two pieces eliminated in the current model, though. That would be the retailer handling and processing and the distributor handling and processing. What would replace it is the redemption center handling and processing, and then they would take the salvage materials to market.
Okay. And the 5 cents is the amount that's been collected from the consumer on each container, and then is there a 3 cents in addition, so it's 8 cents in effect that's being being paid over? Here, I'm just trying to understand the dollar flow.
Madam Chair, Representative McPherson, yes, the nickel would be the same as it is today for the consumer. So the consumer, that process wouldn't change. The nickel they pay at the register is the nickel they'll get back at the redemption center. They don't lose any ground in the middle there. The retailer would pay the 3 cents to the state for the operations. And we'd pay that on a per unit basis, but we would pay that separate to the consumer.
So it's just a nickel, 3 cents of which goes to the state, and then the difference, 2 cents. Okay, help me.
Madam Chair,
for an attorney, so we have to walk him through this.
Representative McPherson. Okay, you have 8 billion hours.
He doesn't make lawyer jokes.
No, the nickel will be just the same. The consumer will pay a nickel and get a nickel back. That nickel goes in and out. Today, we don't receive any piece of that nickel. The retailer does not. Okay? Does that make sense?
Well, except that today, that nickel goes upstream to the distributor. I mean, and in effect, and that's where the dollars, there's an escheat, as it's sometimes called, that's where it ends up, is at the distributor level. But under this system here, the distributor's not in that flow of cash. So I'm trying to figure out how this changes.
Madam Chair, Representative McPherson, picture in your mind you have that distributor there. Now, put a big X through it and put State of Oregon. Now, we'll take the nickel from the consumer and we'll give it to the State of Oregon. Okay? The State of Oregon will give it to the consumer if they come back to the redemption center and bring their container.
Okay.
For every container that doesn't come back, the State of Oregon will have unredeemed nickels.
Gotcha.
Now, move that aside. For every case of product that comes into our store, as it travels over the cash register, it'll be barcoded in a separate system, and we'll pay 3 cents to the state to run the redemption center operations.
It's totally separate
from the deposit. But so, you have to find some funding for redemption center someplace, and what we're saying is we're going to step up and do that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for the clarification. Representative Berger, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you very much for indulging me. As you know, I've had quite an interest in this issue. Mr. Gilliam, is it your intention that every retailer of every juice or pop or beer or in container in the state of Oregon is on board in paying out 3 cents per container under the system?
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, I know your name. I remember.
I think I know you too.
I'm not sure I understand your well, system. Are you saying, is every retailer in favor of this proposal? Or are you saying that every retailer would be part of the system?
Well, I guess the funding mechanism that you're proposing would put a 3 cent, basically, bounty paid to the state on every container sold. Am I incorrect in that? Isn't that what you just described to him?
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, yes.
Okay. So that means that all the people, every retailer who sells in this state would be responsible to collect and send to the state 3 cents for every container. I guess there's an awful lot of retailers in this state. Are you speaking for all of them?
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, I'm speaking for the majority of folks who are in the bottle bill today, but I don't speak for every retailer in the state. There's no association that does.
And I understand that, but what we're talking about is an expansion beyond current beverage containers into a whole bunch of things that are not currently covered in the bottle bill, are we not?
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, yes, we are. It's kind of like the original bill before us. We're talking about new items into the bottle bill.
Yeah.
And how do you fund it?
Do you have a sense of how many new individual items? You've done some math based on containers. Do you know how many? I mean, I guess what you're proposing looks good on paper, but where are the numbers on how many juice containers that are not currently accounted for at all would be included under this bottle bill? Who sells them? How they're going to collect them? There's a huge number of questions here to get to your $30 to $60 million, and then some other important questions are: how much does a recycling center cost?
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, the estimate on about 2 billion containers is pretty close. Since I represent the folks that sell most of the beverage containers in the state, they can tell you what the market and what the value of that is in the system. So you're about 2 billion containers. It could be more, which means we would have to pay more. But since we're paying per unit, it's going to be incremental as we go up. If we're paying it, it's being processed. If it has to be processed, it has to be paid for. It's just that simple. So the beauty about us paying and stepping up and paying the 3 cents per container is we're not going to leave any of the containers short. We're not putting a maximum per year. We're not putting a cap on how many containers we'll pay for. We're going to pay for each and every container. So whether it's a billion, 2 billion, or 3 billion, we're going to pay the freight all the way through the system. Now, the 3 cents is in the other piece of legislation that the recyclers brought forward. If you can't do it for $60 million a year, I just can't imagine that we can't get it done for that.
Right.
It costs us about that today to do the bottle bill. We're going to be consolidating. We're going to be finding efficiencies. And there's no reason that we can't do it for that price.
One more question. Mr. Gilliam, in the current legislation, there is an entire piece on a task force to look at a different way of doing this. I hope if Senate Bill 707 passes, which I hope it will, that this is the perfect piece for that task force to take as a model for how we should be moving. 707, of course, is a pretty small change. It just adds water. It's seen that if we make a major wholesale change to our current bottle bill system, there's a lot of unanswered questions, including ones that have been discussed today. So I applaud that and hope that you will be bringing this proposal to that task force with some real meat on it that we could move forward on it. Because you're right, redemption centers, which have always been available to the grocery industry for 36 years of the bottle bill, they've never been precluded, but there's never been a funding mechanism. And if you're going to come forward with this funding mechanism, I'm sure this task force would love to hear about it.
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, the reason this proposal is now before you, there is no way to make the current bill work at the street level. And we are here saying we can jump ahead. You can do a task force. You have no data. You don't know what your numbers will be. You don't know what the escheat is. And you'll spend 8 months doing what the task force did, the study groups did in this building the last couple months. And you'll come out with nothing concrete, and it'll be 2009, and you won't get there because you don't have the data to do it. So what we're offering here is an actual solution that puts the money on the table to a system that we know it's been done in other states that could be set up. It's already been proposed in this system. And be real honest with you, and all due respect to you, Representative Berger, our guys are so serious about how bad the bill is and how much it'll mess up their systems and be untrackable and how much money they'll lose trying to find the nickels, that they'll go to the people on this in order to get it done, because 707 just plain doesn't work. I wouldn't be here offering this committee $60 million if 707A worked. Why would we do that? It doesn't work.
Madam Chair, one more point. If you can make it work with $60 million, why wouldn't you offer it to the task force?
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, if 707 went into place with the Section 2 requirements, the cows left the barn. We're going to have to upgrade our systems, provide more machines, more building, or go to hand sorting for that period of time to track the brands. We don't need to wait. We don't need to wait for the task force to get done. Here it is. And you have your funding source. Or you can go back in a work group and stare at each other and say, well, who's going to pay?
One more comment, Madam Chair. Mr. Gilliam, you and I have had many conversations, including last fall, about possibilities for changing the bottle bill. In those conversations, is it not true that no mention was ever made of this kind of a scheme up until this day?
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, at 7 o'clock this morning, my board approved this. So we have talked about redemption standards. We've talked about handling fees. We've talked about being paid. I'll just tell you, because 707A is before us the way it is written, we are giving you a workable system, and we're paying for it. I don't know more what else we could do to try to make the bottle bill work.
Thank you, Mr. Cannon.
Thank you. I think Representative Cannon had a question, and somebody's cell phone or BlackBerry is going off because we're hearing a lot of buzzing up here, so everyone check their pockets. That was you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually did want to follow up on one line of questioning from Representative Berger, and that has to do with who you represent. And I just want to be clear. Do you represent Costco, which sells, at least in my part of the world, a lot of the bottles and cans?
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, no, we do not.
Do you represent 7-Eleven, the other mini-marts that are lined Gleason Avenue right by my house?
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, we do have 7-Eleven as a member. I don't know about all the other mini-marts. We have many members that are associate members for our coupon service who are not full voting members. So for the most part, you see 7-Elevens are a member of ours. And most of them are smaller independent stores that have a little more size, like your Thriftways and those types of stores. And then a large part of our membership is Super Value, Albertsons, Fred Meyer, Winco, Safeway, QFC, Higgins, Lamb's, Zupan's, and Portland Gresham Food for Less, and on down the list. So it's that local grocer where you're taking your bottles and cans.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate that, and I don't ask it to be difficult, to know sort of where this is coming from and what other folks we need to talk to about a.
Fair enough. Levy. I mean, that's a very fair question.
I appreciate that. My last question for now has to do with the fact that under your proposal, the current bottle bill would stay in place until January 1, 2010. Under Senate Bill 707, as drafted, the current bottle bill would stay in place until January 1, 2009. So I take some issue, I think, with your point in this letter that Senate Bill 707 would have us expand the bottle bill and then build the capacity. Isn't it in fact the case that grocers, if 707 passes as we have it here, grocers will have, well, about a year and a half to work with distributors and others to build the capacity before having to accept water bottles?
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, what I meant by that was, and I'm sorry if I confused you, what I meant by that was, is if you have us go online in 2009 and the task force then comes out and says, well, we're going to go to redemption centers, we're going to spend a bunch of money on gearing up for 2009, buy machines, expand bottle bill rooms, you know, make capacity, and then we're going to go to redemption centers. So forget you about your investment. Well, now we have a one-year investment in a bunch of machines. If we don't make the investment, then we're going to have very long lines, and we're going to try to start going with the branding issue and try to figure out how we're going to hand sort. So we'll do all this, and for a year later, it may go someplace else. We don't know what it looks like, what it might be. So that's what I was trying to get. Waste all those resources instead of saying, give us time to get to a redemption center model, and it's going to take a little time to build it. For a year prior to it going into effect, to show good faith, we're going to pay a penny and a half during the year prior and pay $30 million in the pot to make it work. And then in 2010, you can make the move and have the capacity to take in the expansion. So more of a let's prepare and get, you know, make sure that the spick is going to be big enough for the flow.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hey, Representative Seth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee, I guess I'm willing to admit that I'm not a master negotiator, as some on here are. But in the course of doing my little business, one of the things I've learned is sometimes it's best for me to check my pride at the door and recognize that there's better ways and better approaches. And I think what's been brought forward to us today by the Northwest Grocers Association is a new framework for looking at how do we manage the bottle bill in the state. And the notion that they're willing to step up and to break a logjam, to me, says I'm willing to check my pride at the door and take a look at this this initiative. Obviously, there's little details to be worked out, but a major, major logjam has been broken here. The question I have goes back to that comment, and I'm curious, how did the distributors feel about this? Would it be possible to bring up Mr. Romaine to hear his thought on this issue?
I was planning to do that after we finished the line of questioning with our current representatives up here. Do you want to speak for the
Madam team? Chair, they have not given that authority.
I think we have a couple more questions first for Mr. Gilliam, and then I will call up some other folks.
I will call up Paul
Romaine in a minute. Representative Jensen, you had a question?
Just kind of quick and easy question. Do you have any models where this is working?
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, the redemption models are in Maine and California. There is one in Hawaii that they're having a lot of trouble with, but it's a very different system and a very different environment.
What I'm talking about models.
So there are. I beg your pardon.
What I'm talking about is not a model of a redemption center, a model similar to what you're proposing to put on the ground.
Yes, there are other states who do this type of
this
model. Yes,
in this way.
Maine.
Similar. Maine's very similar.
Follow up?
Do you know what states those happen to be?
As we heard testimony last week from Kevin Dietley, Maine is the closest one to this model and the state of Oregon and how our bottle bill works. So Maine would be your closest one. California would be your closest neighbor in terms of how they do it, and they have some models that work pretty efficiently also in terms of small redemption type modified boxes that are manned and brought in, take up a small amount of space.
I thought I understood, and then I got a little confused. And excuse me, it's late in the day. I've been up a long time, and I'm getting tired. But I'm specifically concerned with a model similar to what you are proposing here, not Oregon's existing model, not does anyone have something similar to what Oregon has, but is this something that is what you're proposing brand new and never been tried? Is it something that has a base that I can go look at someplace else and see what kind of results we get with it?
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, yes. Look into Maine and look into California, and you will get an idea of some different models.
California is a disaster, and Maine is semi-successful, if I understand what data that I've been shown here.
I don't know that you can say it's a disaster. Representative Jensen, the chair has more experience with Maine than I do, so I'm going to say defer to her.
I would say that Representative Jensen, as I'd mentioned before, I did work for the state of Maine when the bottle bill was expanded, and this is very similar to the state of Maine's system. However, and the state of Maine did capture the sheet. They collected it from the retailers, and then it was the source of funding for redemption centers. They did have a challenge in that the number of redemption centers that were set up, that was part of what, I don't want to say was unsuccessful, but there were some issues about the number of redemption centers, and that was part of what caused some issues with the problem with the system. And there are some problems that they're working out. They did rescind part of the law that I'd worked on. The state of Maine covers all containers, including liquor bottles and wine. And the rate of deposit for those are at 15 cents. Yeah, 15 cents. The rest of the deposits at 5. But the state did control the sheet in a different system than what we have in place. So we had a presentation that walked through all the different state systems, and Maine is probably most similar to what's being proposed here. So that is similar. The question is redemption centers and who controls them and where they're set up. Also, Maine did not include, the proposal in front of you includes batteries, household electronics, and plastic bags. We already voted on House Bill 2626 that sets up a system for household electronics. Batteries, there's no requirement in the state now for recycling of batteries, although lead-acid batteries are banned from landfills. And plastic bags, there's no requirement for mandatory recycling.
Madam Chair, I appear to be doing something differently than everybody else is, because I'm distinguishing between something which is mostly similar, or the most similar, and something which is the same. And it was the same that I'm looking for, and if I don't say that with a, you know, writing off the proposal. If nobody's ever done it, it's not worth trying. I'm certainly willing to look at, talk about, and discuss, you know, doing something that somebody else has never done before. If that, you know, but if we have somebody who has done exactly the same thing, then I just want to know what kind of problems they've run into and what kind of solutions they've been able to work out of them.
And Representative Jensen, I appreciate the comment. I will say that since we don't have a national bottle bill in the United States, there are how many states? There's 11. I was going to say about a dozen. And every single state has a different system. I don't think there's any state system that is exactly identical. And each one is unique. I would say this is the closest out of all the systems I've seen to the state of Maine.
There are some states that don't do anything, aren't they?
There's only about a dozen that have a bottle bill.
Yeah, and so there are a whole bunch of states that are exactly the same.
That's true, and that they do nothing. I was going to say, once a professor, always a professor.
Nice recovery.
I think Representative Burley wanted to make a comment, and then we will bring up Paul Remain and some other folks who wanted to comment on this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know how I can follow on that one, Representative Jensen, but I just wanted to offer some
question.
Comments on what I've been listening to here. And first of all, I too, although the timing may not be the best in some respects, but the fact of the matter is you've stepped up here with a pretty solid alternative, and one that I think deserves some further exploration. And you don't need to answer this right now, but of course one of the things I'm curious about is how the whole curbside recycling would fit into this, or would it replace that as well. But you know, listening to this, I guess a couple of the comments I have is, one member said that 707A is written just to add water, but I would submit that part of the problem is by adding water, we're breaking the circle of trust that we've been so used to between the distributors, retailers, and customers, and we're now going beyond the exclusive territories of franchises, which is what's introducing and causing a lot of the concern and pushback on this thing. You, Mr. Gilliam, mentioned the fact that under 707A, if it were to be enacted, which, my friend, I'm not sure, is there an emergency clause?
There is.
You would have to immediately start upgrading systems and that type of stuff. I'm presuming it's not coincidental that your time frame and your proposal actually dovetails very nicely with the idea that the task force would report back to the legislature by November 1, 2008. I'm presuming that's not coincidental.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, I did not include a task force in my proposal.
I think their proposal replaces.
It would be my intention to replace the task force. Now, that doesn't mean, rather than have the charge of the task force is to develop a new system, is we may have a task force to implement the new system and give it a different charge. So that's, you know, something totally open to that.
Well, I guess where I was headed here was that, you know, I could see 707 being amended to include the task force and its directive, as I mentioned in the last hearing on this, to look more holistically at the whole waste stream in general than just limit to the bottle bill, but also to take your proposal today and any others like this that come forward and really hash them out so we can come back and you know, work on a new waste recycling proposal that is a more holistic system.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, I hope I'm understanding you right. You know, one of our biggest problems is the way that 707 is written doesn't mechanically work for us. So we don't want to start into that system trying to, you know, kind of piece it together and then go off to something else. If that's off the table, you know, part of it is having a grand plan that says, how do you get there? How do you handle capacity? How are you really going to handle it rather than just start into it and then say, well, let's go on to something else. That's wasting. It'll be millions of dollars wasted in resources trying to hobble along. So that's why I set it up as, you know, give it to 2010 to get this thing implemented, because it's going to take a while to figure out the bug. Representative Jensen's right. There's going to be some bugs.
Right.
I mean, but it gives you enough time to get there.
Well, and
follow up.
Thank you.
And the money will be there to help you get there.
Well, I did understand that, and I was being misunderstanding. No, I understood that, and that's why I was suggesting perhaps 707 be amended to take out the change in the bottle bill as it is.
I got you.
Roll out
okay.
The task force. Let's spend the next whatever length of time is, year or so, really hashing this stuff out and come back with a proposal. The one last comment I'd like to make, Madam Chair, is following up on Representative Jensen's question, and I'm not going to try and split hairs between same or similar, but you know, I would submit that what we need to do is take a harder look at what other states have done and capitalize on their experiences and come up with a proposal that takes advantage of that information.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Gilliam. Appreciate you coming up and walking through the proposal. I think we'll invite up a few other folks so we can hear their perspective as well.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
You're welcome.
We appreciate it.
Thank you. Mr. Romaine, would you like to come up?
I'd like to come up.
Some questions. How about would you please come up to the witness stand? So I think there was a question from Representative Smith about what the distributors thought of the proposal, so I think we're anxious to hear what your thoughts are.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm the attorney for the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. And I can't tell you what the distributors think about it because I've only had a chance to call one distributor. I got this proposal about 2 hours ago, and I've been reading through it. And let me just give you some first blush kind of thoughts on it. Well, I'm reminded of the Shakespeare play, Julius Caesar. You know, I'm... but Brutus is an honorable man,
March,
or whatever. So, you know, I am going to praise, but devil's in the details of this stuff, so just remember. First of all, there seems to be an implication here that somehow we are opposed to giving up all the millions of dollars that we make off the bottle bill annually. And let me be real clear with you. If you take us out of the bottle bill, you can have all the millions of dollars we make, every penny of it, and then you can distribute it the way you wish to do so. As long as we don't have any duties under a system, we have no right or shouldn't have any income from a system. So we have no problem with that if we are totally out. And I mean out like you are not going to call us 2 years from now or 4 years from now or 6 years from now and say, the system's broke, we need you to come back in and help fund it or redo the old system. That's our biggest concern with going into anything new. So when you take us out, as this proposal does, our first blush is to say, God bless you. And the second blush is to say, what are the problems? And because nobody is that nice to us, ever. The devil, again, is going to be in the details. This proposal actually does exist. It exists in California. The funding mechanism is different. Here it's a retailer-funded mechanism. But basically, you have redemption centers in California, so you know what your redemption rate in California is. And your redemption rate is going to be directly dependent on the number of redemption centers you have, your convenience. That's the beauty of the California system is you get it out of the grocery stores and stuff. The negative to the system is you don't have as many redemption centers. But then that, again, is a policy choice you have to make as legislators. We in the industry will do whatever you want us to do. Funding source is interesting. The retailer pays, again, on that you would have to ask the retailers who are going to be paying for this whether they like you to be, in effect, sticking a sales tax on their stuff. Because if you happen to be at Costco who sells a lot and doesn't redeem a lot, you have a pretty good system the way it is today, and you may not want to go to a system where you're paying on everything. That doesn't mean they shouldn't. But, you know, obviously a Fred Meyer or a Safeway who takes back a ton of stuff more than they sell likes a system like this, and some of the convenience stores and others who don't take back as much as they sell probably wouldn't like something like this. So, again, you have to ask those folks, not me. As far as unredeemed, again, do not bank on unredeemed deposits. It all depends on the year. Right now, your redemption rate is low, but it's been 103%, at least in the Crink area, in the mid-90s. And if it ever spikes like that, then you've got to somehow figure out a way to fund that. So that's another thing you're going to have to at least be concerned about. Again, I don't want to go through every little detail of this thing, but it's great that it was brought forward. All ideas are good. I don't care where they come from or what they are or if they hurt my client or don't hurt my client. All ideas are good. You need to consider every one of them. But, again, you have to look at how it's going to be implemented, what's going to happen, and how the system will work. You are going away from the system you currently have, which isn't a bad thing in the abstract. But, again, like I go back to, the devil's in the details. Yeah, happy to answer any questions.
Questions? I was going to say I have one, but I'll see if any of my members have questions first.
Representative Berger. Is this not, Mr. Romaine, exactly as you describe in terms of working out the details, what the task force is charged with? Working out the details of a system?
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, and the sirens blare as he starts to speak. This is something we would anticipate coming to the task force, but it is something you could do today. I mean, you know, you could. I wouldn't recommend you take this and do it like immediately. You need to look at all these things. Your task force is set up to do just that, and that's one of the functions. Again, as we stated in the work group, the task force should have as broad a mandate as possible because you need to look at all different ideas out there. We don't have a lock on all good ideas, although I think most of mine are pretty good.
Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Romaine, based on the experience that the distributors have working through their consortiums, through Crink, and I think there's another one they operate as well, do you have an impression, even just sort of rough impression about the economics of the 3 cents and a number of different redemption centers that are functionally doing what Crink does now, which is gathering in all this material and then processing it to get it into the recycling stream.
Madam Chair, Representative McPherson, in effect, these redemption centers are doing more than what Crink does. Crink does the collection from, in effect, the redemption centers.
Right.
And the processing of the material. At first blush, when I look at the numbers, and again, I don't do operations on this, but when I've had folks run numbers, I think you can do a lot of little redemption centers that are, you know, if you sort of co-op grocery stores for the numbers that they're talking about. But again, I'd have to leave that for the experts. But what you're saying here is you're not really going to have a Crink to go out to pick up from all these redemption centers. These redemption centers will be independently operated. A Crink may go out of business, or in fact, Crink may market itself as a redemption center operator, which is something Crink has talked about. I know about actually getting into that business, whether you change the bottle bill or not change the bottle bill. But I can't really comment on that. On the economics.
If I could. I appreciate the fact that you're just getting sort of a first blush reaction to it, but functionally, what is being done at Crink would be going on at each one of these redemption centers, and as you observe, something more than that too, which is receiving material from the public directly and paying redemption amounts. But I guess as to the economics of scale of what is going on at Crink now, which is a big operation, and so you see a lot of economies of scale going on, that's going to have to happen either at each one of these redemption centers, or the redemption centers are going to have to, in effect, combine together to have a facility like Crink. And does that make sense? I mean, I've visited the Crink facility. I've seen what it looks like a major capital investment. So give us a reaction to that situation.
Madam Chair, Representative McPherson, we're getting close to where Maine's problem came in. In effect, what happened in Maine was there is no limit on the number of redemption centers, and so you have a whole bunch of redemption centers that really don't make any money. And so, because they have to process the stuff, each one's doing, in effect, the same as combining. And that's why the handling fee in Maine kept going up. Each year, that's the big battle in Maine, is whether the handling fee goes up more. How do you fund that? So there's sort of a magic number somewhere out there between convenience, because you want a lot of places to redeem, but if the more you have, the more inefficient they are. The bigger they are, the more efficient they are, the cheaper they are to operate, but the less convenient they are for the consumer. So you're sort of in this how do you do it scenario. And again, I can just point out problems. I can't give you answers right now.
Thank you, Mr. Romaine. I have one final question before we hear. I'd like to hear from the consumer point of view, because I think I saw Jeremiah Bauman from Oxford. Regarding the sheet, and in the proposal that the grocers handed us, they said, and we've heard these numbers before, the sheet could range from $0 to $15 million per year. And so we've discussed as part of, in the existing Senate Bill 707, in order to make any type of decisions about redemption centers, there has to be accurate information about the type of funds that we're talking about to initiate these redemption centers. So would you be opposed to the reporting, setting up a reporting system to the legislature that actually provides information, or to the task force on the undeemed bottle deposits?
Madam Chair, we have said that we would think that that would be a subject that the task force should look into. Right now, there are so many different ways that people account for deposits or don't account for deposits. Again, as we've stated before, there is no requirement in the bottle bill that we charge a deposit. Anything we take in from the consumer is not segregated out. We pay income tax on that money. So technically, there are really technically no deposits out there right now. There are some distributors, if you're part of a co-op, where you are going to distinguish that out. But if you're not, if you heard some stuff at the work group from some soft drink distributors, small folks, that, hey, it's just income. There's not a separate line item for deposit. It's all income to us. So you would have to direct them to set up an accounting system to account for it. And so that's something that you probably, you know, the task force should look into. What is the way you want it to be accounted for?
I will take that as a no. You don't have any objection to the reporting of those.
That's a double negative. I don't have any objection to having the task force look into it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. We'll have the consumer advocates come up, please.
Thank you very much.
Or advocate. Actually, I also will ask the recyclers to come up since they were also a member of the work group. Just so you know, you're on deck.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeremiah Bauman with OSPIRG, Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. I'm actually the environmental advocate, for the record. I could get a consumer advocate down, too. Shall I start with just general reaction? Well, I guess I'd echo the comments that many have said today, which is, I think, first of all, this is, I think, primarily a helpful proposal in the sense that it changes the debate significantly to have another option to look at. And I think it's only helpful to bring more ideas to the table and look at other options that would bring other people on board with improving recycling in Oregon. Many people have said, and probably what is the fundamental rule of the bottle bill, the devil is in the details on all of this. The proposal, as far as I understand it, and I only have the one-page version, not even the two-page version, so I'm working with even more limited information, brings a lot of good ideas to the table, and certainly adding more containers is a very good thing for recycling. I think especially from a consumer perspective, where it's hard to decide what the rational case is for water or juice in either order. So I think that is certainly a good thing. And there are also good ideas in here about, I think, ways of getting recycling going for other products as well. I guess there are two primary things that grab my attention that would need a lot more exploration and discussion before being known what to do with that, and I'd leave it to the committee to decide how much longer, given the timeline we're on, to keep discussing this versus shifting things to the task force. One is, and I think there's a lot of people who support the bottle bill because of its simplicity, at least until you dig into the details. Simplicity in the sense of the near lack of government involvement. The legislature said 36 years ago, you shall provide a refund when consumers bring these bottles back and you'll collect them and go recycle them. Everything else is figured out outside the government, and it works remarkably well. So that's certainly a major change here, and that I think alone would require pretty significant investigation to figure out what the best way to do that is. This bill would require heavily on DEQ to make sure there's enough redemption centers for convenience to manage all the money. So it just changes that piece of it in a big way. The redemption centers, of course, are the major place that it would also be just systemic change for how the bottle bill handles things right now. And that would be a significant concern for OSPIRG that we figure out a way to make sure that will actually work. It's a difficult issue. My primary concern looking at the numbers is my instinct is I doubt that this amount of money could pay for enough redemption centers to maintain convenience. If for no other fact that, if I understood Mr. Gilliam correctly, $60 million is about what the grocers currently spend on implementing the bottle bill. That inherently isn't enough to do the exact same process with a separate parallel infrastructure because the grocers, I assume they're not counting land acquisition, buildings, staff time, that is probably, I imagine, a fair amount of staff that do other things besides work on bottle collection. So there are a whole set of other overhead expenses that are added as soon as you move it to a separate system. Now, you could do it. You'd need fewer redemption centers handling a higher volume, so you could probably make it work for that money. But again, that's when you get into the trade-off between consumer convenience. One of the main reasons the bottle bill works for consumer convenience is precisely because there are a set of places that it doesn't make a whole lot of economic sense for being redemption centers. There are a lot of small stores that probably don't get more than a handful of bottles every month, and that you couldn't have a redemption center. That would never pay for itself. It would be a money-losing venture. But if it's a store, they're not trying to make money off of the 5 or 10 bottles. I don't know if it's 10 or 50 or 100, but it's not much volume. So you have to. There is inherently a trade-off between economic redemption center system and a convenient redemption center system. And as other people have said, it's been very hard to make that work. California struggled for a very long time with low recycling rates. I've heard they're coming, they're getting higher now. Maine had the kind of opposite problem. They did the right thing for convenience and had lots and lots of redemption centers, but that cost lots and lots of money, and a lot of the centers were getting very little volume, so the economics weren't working, and so they had to keep raising the fee to keep up with it. There are ways to get around that, I think. One would, the recyclers had a very good proposal for how you could get to redemption centers, which is you have it basically, you put more oversight over the system, so there's a mandatory recycling rate. Mm-hmm. So the government doesn't say how many centers you need, it's just you have to maintain 80 or 90, whatever the right number is, percent recycling rates. Mm-hmm. And so that's what determines, apparently you don't have enough redemption centers, you better go add some more, and you pay as much as it costs to get to that rate. The other way I can think of would be kind of a, I don't know, even more, in the spirit of the original bottle bill, let the market figure it out, would be you just simply, you have to first decide who pays the fee to whoever collects the bottle. So it could be the retailers, as in this proposal, it could be the distributors, it could be the manufacturers. But then you just say whoever collects the bottle gets the fee. So the grocers, if the grocers continue to collect the bottles, then they either don't pay the fee to anybody, they keep the money, or if someone else is paying the fee, they get to collect those fees to compensate themselves. Or if a redemption center does open up, they would get as many fees as they collect bottles. So it just kind of let the market figure out if there's a market for redemption centers, then they would work. That would be the funding mechanism. You wouldn't require grocers to stop taking them back, nor would you require redemption centers to be set up. You would simply say that whoever does collect the bottles gets the fee. So I guess those are my initial thoughts. Certainly, again, the devil's in the details. There'd be a lot more to look at and think about here. But I think the most important message is this is incredibly helpful to have a proposal come forward, and it's, I think, always good to look at some more ideas and think about whether there's a way to make this work for everybody.
Thank you. Any questions for Jeremiah? Representative Cannon.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you, Jeremiah. You mentioned California's rates. Apparently, that's the best model. Do you have a notion of what those are, the recycling rates?
I don't have the right file with me. When I last, the numbers I have only went through 2000, and they were on the order of at least 10 percentage points worse than Oregon's. So that would mean, you know, somewhere in the 60s or somewhere in the 50s or 60s, I believe. They varied a lot over time, and you can't pin that all on redemption centers. They also have different redemption values for different containers, which inherently I think confuses consumers, so results in slightly less redemptions. You can't keep track how much you're going to get when you do take it back. And a lot of them are very small. Some of them are starting as low as a penny and 2 pennies, and they've recently, I know, been raising those redemption values, and they've gotten their rates up because of that. So I don't know if you can sort out to what extent it was because there weren't enough redemption centers or they weren't in the right locations.
Just a second question, Manager. Yeah, thanks. Would it be correct to assume, I mean, just from your point of view, that this 3 cent handling fee would get passed on to the consumer in the price of the drink? Essentially, it would raise the price of the beverage by 3 cents.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, I assume that is correct, or at least some portion of it. You know, the market competitive pressure will, you know, limit how much price increase can happen, depending on what the cost to the manufacturer and the retailer is. Osprey's perspective on it is a handling fee, in essence, a non-refundable fee, should be one of the players in the system that has more market power to decide what kinds of containers we're using. So probably preferable would be essentially like the electronic waste legislation this committee already passed. The manufacturer is probably the most principled place to put that, because they're probably the one choosing which bottles it goes in. It's not that clean for beverages, because in some cases the manufacturer essentially is the distributor because they're putting it into bottles. So you theoretically, you know, if someone's going to pay a fixed fee, you want them to be someone who at least could theoretically change what's going on to avoid the fee, much like the original bottle bill actually still has probably a 2 cent deposit for refillable bottles. Consumers can't do anything about it. No individual consumer has any leverage over the market to respond to the fee. So it just simply then does because of a straight out fee and not any kind of incentive anywhere in the system.
Thanks.
Representative Smith and Representative Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jeremiah, my knowledge on recycling centers is pretty limited. But statutorily, don't we require local government to provide recycling locations?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I'm not sure exactly how those requirements work. I know that, you know, curbside recycling is required in communities of a certain size and higher. So my guess is to the extent recycling centers are required, it probably applies similarly.
Yeah, I would share, and I'm on thin ice on this, but I know in Wheeler County, after talking with Judge Birch in Wheeler County, that I know they're mandated to maintain a recycling location. And so I guess my question off of that would be, in terms of geographic location, potentially couldn't it make sense that taking these redemption centers and tying it in with the statutorily mandated recycling centers, isn't there? Couldn't there potentially be an opportunity to have the two overlay and just complement each other?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I would imagine that to the extent existing recycling centers could function as redemption centers, that would not only be possible, it would certainly reduce the overhead costs and make the system more sustainable. My instinct is I doubt there are enough of those to maintain the level of convenience that you'd need. But that could also work in a system where whoever collects it gets the fee, so that if that recycling center wanted to collect them, they could also get reimbursed for a portion of their costs.
Just to follow up, and Madam Chair, I guess I just want to share why I have enthusiasm for this option that's brought forward. Again, in rural Oregon, where I represent, right now we don't, in our small communities, we don't have an option for conveniently recycling all beverage containers. The nearest location is 30 miles away. If there was an opportunity to have a redemption center, though, I can see where my kids who collect all the pop cans could also have another container location where all the other plastics go into, and when they go to the redemption center to plunk their cans in, they could also take the other plastics. And to me, this just seems like a tremendous win-win for the environment for rural Oregon. And so I just want to share that with you.
Thank you. Representative Berger, we'll call up the last witness.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you for indulging me. Jeremiah, the same question that I basically asked Mr. Gilliam and Mr. Romain, the details that you have outlined, and you are quite knowledgeable and articulate in this whole area, are exactly the details that we envision for the task force. Is that not correct? That these are the details that need to be worked out over time by a knowledgeable group, and that is the vision for this task force.
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, that is correct. And I do think that a level of this complexity, especially when you start changing the entire system, rather than building on a system that exists and works, probably is best resolved by somebody who has a little more time to do that. I will agree that I think there's a little bit of a dilemma, which is the task force doesn't have a whole lot more information than the people who have been working on this for the last, you know, since January, or in Representative Berger's case, longer. In terms of how much there is in underdue deposits year to year, in terms of how much the grocers are currently paying, in terms of how much the current distribution system pays for the collection piece of it. So there is certainly part of me that says I don't know how the task force is going to resolve the issue, except by continued debate and just making a decision. There's also part of me that says perhaps the best way to figure that out is to sort of proceed on two paths simultaneously, which is add at least a portion of the beverage containers that we want to add, and see how the system reacts at the same time that a body is studying that system, to at least see if it's true the system can't handle it. That's at least one objective piece of information we would get, is what happens when you expand the bottle bill. That seems to me like the one sort of objective piece of information that the task force would have is that the water bottles are coming into the system now, as long as it extends its life into the time when they're actually starting to come in. So I think there is a little bit of a dilemma there that I'm not sure a task force will solve all of our problems. But certainly, this is the kind of issue that requires some thoughtful consideration by the people who are in the best position to do it.
Other questions? Right, thank you. Thank you, Jeremiah. Will the recyclers come up? Since they were also part of the work group. And please state your name for the record.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, Kristen Leonard and Alex Kyler, representing the Association of Oregon Recyclers. We want to come up and talk ever so briefly about this proposal, but wanted to let everyone know that at this point in time, the association does not have a position on the proposal. In fact, they may just be hearing about this for the first time as they're all listening online to the hearing as well. So We just wanted to briefly go through a couple elements of the proposal that are very interesting to us and then be available to answer any questions. In looking at page 3 of the outline put out by the grocers, I think what we'd like to do is just touch upon a couple of the things in the overview. The Association of Oregon Recyclers came into this session with Senate Bill 634. This was years of kind of comprehensive looking at how do you not only expand Oregon's bottle bill, but also modernize the redemption process. And the association has been very eager to look at ways to start looking at redemption centers, alternative ways of redeeming these materials, but also, you know, knowing that that would allow Oregonians to expand into additional materials being recycled. So the elements that in this proposal that are very similar to 634 are the all beverage containers. We believe that that is very important over time, that we make sure all containers are included, and that we look at redemption centers as an alternative to the grocers taking and retail establishment taking all of these materials. And so the way we saw it is grocers could opt in to as a redemption center themselves, but we saw that there were a lot of other opportunities out there. But what needed to happen was some funding stream. And Senate Bill 634 had a 3-cent handling fee that was basically started with the manufacturers in the process. So that's kind of the essence and the overview of what we've already been supportive of in the past and we would continue to support and want to talk about.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, I'm Alex Kyler. I want to be clear, I testified in front of you earlier as the City of Eugene and suggested that we were, as the city, was interested in a bottle bill that would capture unredeemed deposits and be able to be used to support litter programs, education programs, market development programs, that kind of thing. This proposal seems to do that. I want to take that hat off, though, and do wear the hat of the Association of Oregon Recyclers, which I chaired for 4 years, and we tried very, very hard to bring together stakeholders in a discussion to bring forth legislation that would have met the needs of all the parties. Some of you have heard about that effort, and it unfortunately was unsuccessful because it is difficult to get all the stakeholders together. Obviously, you've done a very good job of bringing them to the table, and but I think that the fact that, you know, I've just seen this literally in the past 30 minutes, so hard to kind of think about all the ramifications. Although, as Kristen mentioned, it's quite similar to the proposal that we were advocating for in the beginning of the session, Senate Bill 634. So I do want to just respond to a couple questions that I've heard today, and I'll answer any questions that you might have. Chair Dingfelder, Representative Jensen, you asked, are there other models for this kind of thing? What this proposal appears to do is create a centralized fund where all the deposit money would go into a centralized fund that would be managed by the state and support redemption centers. Centralized funds are in existence in other states and in Canadian provinces as well, where what a centralized fund does is a centralized fund, in my mind, actually improves convenience. Because in today's system, you know, you've probably had the experience where you go into a store and you try to return something, and the store won't accept it because it's not a brand they sell. And that was a fix that was attempted to be made in 707. That was, as you've heard testimony, creating some problems on the distribution end of things and for the smaller operators who might be brokers of water or water manufacturers themselves that are small. But a centralized fund kind of eliminates all those problems because an Oregon unit becomes an Oregon unit becomes an Oregon unit. And there is no need to sort back through all the nickels to make sure that distributor A got their portion and distributor B got their portion, to say nothing of each retailer getting their portion and being made neutral. That's the whole
kind of effort underfoot today. So a centralized fund is good. The difference here is that it's initiated. The retailer role, I think, is somewhat different. I'm not exactly sure that there's a model out there that shows where retailers have initiated that deposit or passed that deposit into a centralized fund. Typically, that is done through the distributor or at the manufacturer level. Chair Dingfelder, Representative Smith, you asked about the existence under Oregon 459 and 459A about what local governments are required to do. And local governments indeed choose from a menu of choices to meet a recycling rate. And so it's kind of a nice flexible way for local governments to participate in a number of recycling methodologies that attempt to reach 50% recycling by the year 2009. Adding something like this to that menu of choices where a transfer station might operate as a redemption center, I think would be doable. There's a number of different models out there where some transfer stations are publicly owned, but maybe with a private contractor. There's some that are publicly owned that are publicly operated, and there are some that are completely privately owned. Pendleton Sanitary is one, and I think actually up in Hermiston, that's another one operated by a garbage company. But there would certainly, I think, some of those folks would be very interested in operating redemption centers. And then I just wanted to address the Representative Burley's that I've heard him speak to. So Chair Dingfelder, Representative Burley, you know, curbside recycling is a fabulous system. The diversity that a bottle bill brings to the state is just another way for people to redeem containers. And notwithstanding the documentation that Kevin Neely Deatley provided about litter, the Association of Oregon Recyclers did a number of litter studies in Oregon, and where we looked at roadside litter as well as park garbage. And what we found, I think that Mr. Deatley's studies, there's two ways to do litter studies. You can do it by piece, where you say a bottle, it's the same as a cigarette butt because they're each one piece of litter. You come out with a lot different number than if you do it by weight, which is what we did. And by weight, we found that beverage containers were 14% of roadside and park-generated litter. You don't see recycling containers at very many parks, unfortunately. You don't even see recycling containers in this building. And the answer is they're very expensive. And they're very expensive then to get collected, and there is no mechanism right now to pay for that. And that's where you might see something like Solve having a role to play and a funding mechanism. For instance, you go down to California, you're going to find an enormous grant program that does pay for recycling containers, and they've been very effective at ski areas, at parks, at stadiums. And this is a way to expand that recycling rate that is not related to curbside, even though the materials all end up in the recycling industry. So those are just some answers that I think I can provide to the committee. But as Kristen indicated, I think it's a little premature for me to endorse this as the Association of Oregon Recyclers. I'm not willing to do that.
Thank you very much for coming up. I have one quick question. The Representative Smith had a question. Regarding Senate Bill 634, did you sit down with the grocers and talk to them about that? And if so, what was their response to that proposal?
Chair Dingfelder, 634 was one of the many bills that were brought to the work group at the very beginning. From the beginning, it was one of the bills that the work group was looking at. So there were several bottle bills, as you all know, that started out in this process, and that was one of the bills that was looked at. And we have had a lot of great conversations with the grocers about different elements of the bill throughout this entire process, and we appreciate their willingness to continue to talk to us about this.
All right, thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When Mr. Gilliam was making his presentation, he talked about setting aside 1.5 cents per beverage container to establish redemption centers. Is it correct to say that we're not starting from zero? We already have established infrastructure around the state with private sector members who have recycling and redemption centers, and this would be adding to that total number?
Yeah. There are The recycling industry has grown a lot in the last 30 years, and there are a number of private players now engaged in processing and collection of materials, and I think that they would certainly be interested in having redemption centers. Whether that would rise to the level of convenience provided by return to retail, I think, is a discussion that's really could be argued. However, as I indicated, the thing about a centralized fund is that that brings a lot of convenience to a system. Personally, I've been very frustrated by going into a store and then leaving with containers and trying to find another store that will take the off brands that I may have collected up along the road, or just because my personal choice of beverage was from different markets. And you also heard Mr. Romaine talk about Crink, for example. They're a very, I mean, that processing infrastructure that Crink and Broco represent is a huge investment. And if they can, it sounded to me like there was some willingness to explore redemption centers, you'd think that that would be a nice niche to feed the processing infrastructure that they have in place.
Just one follow-up.
Quick follow-up, but I am just about to close
yep,
this.
Yeah,
well,
I guess I may be here by myself. as they're working through this, wouldn't there be an opportunity for the private sector to work with local government and the state through a public-private partnership to have the private sector operate these redemption centers and create greater efficiencies?
Quickly. Yeah.
Our association is made up, I mean, with that public-private partnership is that cooperation is characterized by our industry. And we already do so much work with the locals. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. With that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 7078 and close the hearing on the House Energy and Environment Committee.